Welcome to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. Today, WBGO's John Kalis chats with accomplished klezmer musician Zeb Feldman, who is out with a new memoir about his life growing up in the Bronx.
His memoir chronicles a musical pilgrimage to the Greek Orthodox Church in Washington Heights.
I'll chat with two-time Emmy Award winner John Crowley, the executive director of the New Jersey Motion Picture and Television Commission. He'll tell us why the film business in the Garden State is booming.
The irony is that taxes drove the film industry out of New Jersey, and tax incentives are drawing the industry back here.
And film critic Harlan Jacobson was in the mood for wrestling movies following the death of Hulk Hogan last month.
When Saul finally comes out as Cassandro, an exotico, he does it to be truthful to himself and to support his mother.
All this coming up today on the WBGO Journal. Zeb Feldman is an accomplished musician who is considered an authority on Ottoman Turkish music and klezmer, the instrumental music of East European Jews. He's written a memoir about his life growing up in the Bronx and traveling through several musical diasporas in the city. WBGO's John Kalish spoke with him and has this report.
Feldman's father grew up in the town of Ednitz, which was in Bessarabia but is now part of Moldova. Ednitz was ruled by the Turks until the early 19th century, and so the Jews of his father's town had a musical link to the Turks and other ethnic groups.
Our ancestors had lived in Bessarabia when it was still ruled by the Turks. There was a clear sense that the aesthetic of the Greeks, of the Armenians too, of the Turks, fit with our Yiddish aesthetic better than many of the neighboring peoples.
In his memoir, From the Bronx to the Bosphorus, Feldman recounts how, as a student at Music and Art High School, he went to Club Kayam, a Middle Eastern music venue in the East Village. There, he connected with a couple of musicians. One was a percussionist, and the other was a man from Iran who played a hammered dulcimer known as a santur.
I went with a couple of non-musical friends. I don't think it meant all that much to them, but I was fascinated by the two people that I met. The first was the drummer, and the other was the santur player, who was a recent refugee from Iran. There were very few Iranians in New York. This was before the Iranian Revolution.
Feldman took up the santur and also played other versions of the instrument. Feldman also learned how to play the darabuka, a goblet-shaped drum that is also known as a dumbek. His memoir chronicles a musical pilgrimage to the Greek Orthodox Church in Washington Heights, an Armenian music club near NYU, and a section of 8th Avenue in Manhattan below West 30th Street with several Greek nightclubs.
Once I heard the sound of music coming from an upper story outside one of the clubs, and I just walked up the stairs. I had my darabuka with me because I was going to play at one of the Greek clubs, and they were very welcoming. The clubs were based on the girls, the belly dancers, and the clubs were able to survive because people came to see the belly dancers. I don't think those clubs could have survived without that.
One of the businesses in that Greek neighborhood provided Feldman with an education. It was a record store called the Balkan Phonograph Company that sold Turkish, Greek, Armenian, Albanian, Romanian, and Spanish Oriental records.
Other musicians from the clubs would just drop in sometimes. They would make coffee and they would sit, they would play, sing. I would just be sitting in the corner. They let me sit and watch. There weren't a whole lot of customers. Somehow they paid the rent. I don't know how, you know. I still have a lot of 78 recordings that I bought there.
This is Giannis Kyriakatis, a distinguished Greek clarinetist, active in the early 20th century. In the mid-1970s, Feldman met the bluegrass virtuoso Andy Statman and started jamming with him. Statman played mandolin, accompanied by Feldman on cymbalum, a hammered dulcimer used in Eastern Europe.
We had a repertoire of Irish Scottish tunes and, you know, Greek tunes. And one day he asked me, you know, do I know anybody who plays Jewish music as their main thing? He wanted to know someone who played it full time. And of course, I thought of Dave Taras.
Dave Taras was a retired klezmer clarinetist known for his virtuosity. He became Statman's clarinet teacher and in 1978 came out of retirement to perform at a concert with Feldman and Statman, an important milestone in the klezmer revival. In the ensuing years, klezmer bands started popping up all over the country. Feldman writes in his memoir that he and Statman were astonished how rapidly klezmer grew after the 1978 concert with Taras. Feldman views the genre's increased popularity as a positive development, but he disparages the use of vocalists in klezmer bands, which incorporated Yiddish theater songs and other sources into their repertoire.
The klezmer did not play with a singer. There were accompanists for a soloist who was either a clarinetist or a violinist, and the idea of accompanying the singer was degrading. Most of the groups that were performing klezmer music became a mixture of Yiddish folk songs, klezmer melodies. For Andy and I, it was not klezmer music. Almost inevitably, the singer begins to take the center. It's a subversion of what the meaning of a klezmer was.
Feldman taught at elite universities after receiving his PhD in Central Asian literature, but at the age of 76, his formal academic career is behind him. He does teach Yiddish dance and is involved in the Klezmer Institute, which is making recently uncovered musical manuscripts from Ukraine available to klezmer musicians. For the WBGO Journal, I'm John Kalish.
John Crowley is not only the executive director of the New Jersey Motion Picture and Television Commission, but he's also a two-time Emmy Award-winning showrunner, producer, developer, director, and writer. Yes, he does it all. And he's our guest today on the WBGO Journal. John, thanks for being here.
Doug Doyle, thank you for having me.
What a time for New Jersey and the film industry. Both the upcoming Bruce Springsteen film, Deliver Me From Nowhere, and, of course, Bob Dylan film A Complete Unknown were largely filmed in the Garden State. May 13th, Netflix broke ground to redevelop nearly 300 acres in central New Jersey on the grounds of Fort Monmouth for a massive $848 million new film and TV production facility with 12 sound stages. And coming soon, 1888 Studios in Bayonne with 23 sound stages and a 58-acre production hub. And Newark is becoming a hot destination for films. John, why is all this happening now?
Why is it all happening? By the way, you connected the thread between the Springsteen and Bob Dylan biopics. I have a funny feeling that Adam Sandler sings in Happy Gilmore too. So that would be the trifecta, my friend. We'll have three musical biopics, or pictures, I should just say, here in New Jersey. So that's the one. That's the answer to the question I'm looking for. How do we get all this musical talent here in state? But you're absolutely right. I mean, right now is a renaissance in New Jersey in terms of the entertainment industry. Because think about it. If you go back to the beginning of last century, you've got Thomas Edison that invents, you know, the motion picture camera, the black Mariah, right? And so what he was doing is he was charging a tax on all the filmmakers to use his equipment, right? So what happened is they all said, we got to get out of here. We don't want to spend money on a tax to use a camera. And they ran as far away as they could. And when they hit the Pacific Ocean, that was it. And that's when Hollywood was born. So to me, Doug, the irony is that taxes drove the film industry out of New Jersey, and tax incentives are drawing the industry back here. So I'm just going to ask all your listeners if we can just gather hands and sing Circle of Life from Lion King, because it's all come full circle here in New Jersey. One of the reasons why we do what we do at the Film Commission in terms of getting production here and telling people about what we do in New Jersey, what's so great about New Jersey and why they should bring their projects to New Jersey is for the jobs. So when people say they want an experienced LA crew or an experienced New York crew, guess what? They get that in New Jersey. We have the largest experienced workforce outside LA or New York is right here in New Jersey. 40% of IATSE and Teamster members live in New Jersey, and they'd much rather get in the car, drive down the parkway, and be to work in 30 minutes as opposed to having to go through a bridge or a tunnel to get, you know, to the set. We had in 2022 about 16,000 different crew hires. 2017, it was about 17,000. Last year, over 30,000 crew hires. We had a fantastic year in 2024. New York was stagnant. LA was down. Georgia production was down. Louisiana and Texas, their production was down. New Jersey was up 37%. And in workforce, in the crew hires rather, and also in what we measure is the qualified spend. And that's the other reason why we do what we do, is that money, when a production comes into state, they don't bring everything with them. They're not bringing groceries or gas or rental cars or hardware like paint and brushes and nuts and bolts and dry cleaning and all that stuff. They are spending money when the production lands in state. They're spending all that money on all those things right here in New Jersey. And we went from $592 million in qualified spend in 2023. In 2024, we're at about $810 million qualified spend. So with that qualified spend and all those jobs, that's why we do what we do. And we just spread the word, like, why would you want to go anywhere else but New Jersey, you know, when we've got everything you need right here?
Makes so much sense. John, explain the whole tax incentive, you know, picture when it comes to how it helps towns that, you know, like Newark that are welcoming, you know, all kinds of productions.
Yeah, so we have a great tax incentive program here, one of the best in the country. And it's we have a thing called the TMZ, which is the 30-mile zone. That pin drop, if you will, is at Columbus Circle in New York, and draw a 30-mile radius circle. And so you get Newark and you get Hoboken that falls in that area, Paterson, Jersey City. So we see a lot of production in the north. The Film Commission works really hard at getting production in Central and South Jersey. Like, you go down Atlantic City, there's great architecture, great variety of locations, great deals in terms of, you know, you're putting your crew up in a hotel, you can get all sorts of fantastic deals for your crew. So we try to get that we try to get production all throughout the state to do that qualified spend that I talked about. So we spread that money around all through the state. So in the TMZ, in the 30-mile zone, you get a 30% tax incentive. You go outside the circle, it goes to 35%. And why is that? That's to incentivize getting more work in central and Jersey so that we can put our people to work down there and we can get more money spent. It, you know, for instance, when you say, what's the benefit when a production gets into town? Well, Billy Eichner had a parade scene for his movie Bros, and he needed a whole bunch of balloons, and he spent $19,000 in one day on balloons. So you can imagine the balloon shop was ecstatic. So when Spielberg was in state back in May, he was down in Cape May, and he had 350 crew members. Each of them was spending about $285 per night on a hotel room. Well, you do the math. I mean, like, that's a considerable spend, and that was in the off season. So people were, you know, eight hotels it took to take all the staff. So that was a considerable amount of money. And then you add on top of that, that all of them at the end of the day were going to get dinner, and they get a per diem for their dinner, which was, I think, $50-$75 per night. Well, all the crew were having meals at local restaurants. So that was a huge boom in that area because of one production. So, and Doug, I did a film. I directed a film a few years ago, and I was in my town, and we have an empty school building, and I don't have a Spielberg budget. I only had $3 million, but we were paying a daily fee to the school, the property owners. So that was money for them. And then every day my camera department was in the coffee shop, and the owner was saying, John, please don't leave, because every day they come in, your camera department, that's $250 extra dollars that I wasn't counting on that's there. My hardware store was a beneficiary of the production because they needed paint and they needed nuts and bolts and brushes and things like that to build sets. So that was a chunk of money. And in my little town of 5,000 people, we spent about $26,000 in 1 week. That's not bad for a little town. The businesses were ecstatic. That's another reason why we do what we do.
It's fantastic. You mentioned this 30-mile radius. And if you start thinking about, you mentioned the word architecture as well. You start thinking about the old buildings, especially in places like Newark, the wonderful architecture, the old buildings. You know, when I was watching The Joker, I knew all those scenes because all those trucks were outside the WBGO studios. When he was going down the steps, I knew exactly where the Joker was going, and, you know, when that movie was being filmed. But then you have great spaces of land in New Jersey. You have great things like even the Great Falls that you could film something by. You go to the South, you have great farmland. You have, you know, Atlantic City. You have the casinos. There's just about everything you could want in the Garden State when it comes to making a film, and all within that 30-mile radius. That's just another selling point that you're talking about.
We always say on the commission that the incentives are the door opener, right? That's what initially gets the interest of a studio or a network to come to New Jersey to film their project. I think probably number two on the list is what you're talking about, which is our wide variety of locations. So you literally can go one block in a neighborhood, and you've got a Queen Anne or a Victorian style home on one side of the street, and you go one block over and you got a mid-century ranch. You can go from a little tiny Mayberry RFD style town to within a 10-minute drive, you've got a big city. So we double all the time as Washington, D.C. We double all the time as Times Square. We've even doubled as Southeast Asia. We've even doubled as Africa. So there's a huge variety of locations. And again, you know, you can go from the beach to a mountain with snow in 90 minutes, Doug. Like, you can't even go cross town over in the city in 90 minutes on some days, right? So that's a huge draw for a studio because they look at it and they go, hey, time is money. And our script has a need for 10 different looks. And New Jersey's one-stop shopping. We can get all that. You can't get this in L.A., and I grew up in L.A. You can't get this in L.A. There's no old architecture in L.A. They have a beach, and they've got a desert. And by the way, Doug, trivia question, does New Jersey have a desert?
I guess the answer is probably yes.
The answer is yes. Ding, ding, ding. You win. We have 30 acres in Lacey of sand. It was put in for a film. It's still there. So you can still, if you need a desert scene, we've even got that in New Jersey. So you put that, you've got this wide variety of locations, whatever you need, one-stop shop. You add in the incentives. You add in what we also talked about, our experienced workforce, like the third largest workforce in the United States for entertainment experience, right? You add that, and then you throw on the fact that we have a fantastic infrastructure. So those are permanent jobs, and that's like your grip and electric rental companies that are here. We didn't have cameras in state. Now we've got Aeroflex, and we've got Panasonic, and we've got Sony. Those are full-time jobs that are here year-round. We've even got payroll services, and now we've got a couple of lumber mills that specialize in entertainment construction, building sets and things like that, set design construction. You know, you name it. We've got it. And we had a big film expo in May. We're going to do another one next year, I think. And the idea was that we wanted to show the decision makers at the studio and network level, like, hey, whatever your production needs, Jersey's got you covered. So we're turning no's into yeses every day, is something we do on the commission side, just messaging out, why would you say no to New Jersey? Tell me, why would you say no? There's zero reason to say no and every reason to come here and bring your TV or film project.
We're going to talk about your career in a moment, but what has changed more in the film industry? Technology is so incredible now these days that you can create scenes, you can create creatures, you can create anything that you want. Has this, in your estimation, been great for the film industry, or does it take away from some of the wonderful parts of filmmaking?
We always ask ourselves the question, can we harness technology to make it work to the betterment of humankind? And without getting too deep dishy, I would just say that the strikes of the last 2 years revolved a lot around the harnessing of technology and AI and CG, computer generated graphics, and all those sort of things. So we can really use them to our benefit, but the strikes were also about making sure that our jobs are protected of our workers, our skilled workers. So I think they hit a balance. I'll leave that to union leadership in the studios to really get into the nuts and bolts of that. But, we saw an uptick in our hiring, our crew hirings last year, 37%. So that's good. We love seeing that our New Jersey residents are working on projects that are coming in here, and we're getting a bigger slice of the pie, because while everybody else was down across the United States, literally New Jersey was one of the only major states that was up 37% with the amount of production that came in here. So, look, New Jersey's adapting to the rise of technology. So I was just at a location yesterday in Kearney Point that has full-time usage on their stage of what they call the volume. It's a volume LED screen. And, artists, CG artists can create a backdrop, and your actors can move around in front of it, and they look like they're, on scene when in fact they're on a stage, in Kearney Point. So we have three of those in state. We've got all sorts of prop design and construction and set design and construction that utilize 3D printing. Stuff looks fantastic. And I was on a set not too long ago where, it looked like one surface like stone, and it wasn't, it was, some other like plastic like material. So we've got a lot of high tech that's moving into the industry, and New Jersey's not afraid to adapt it and jump in there and put it to use. And that's another draw for anybody that wants to make their film or TV show in New Jersey. We got it all.
Was there a film or TV show that John Crowley saw in your younger days that you said, yeah, I want to be a part of this industry?
Easy answer. The answer is yes. And when I found out that my uncle worked on this movie, was like I had fallen into the bucket of gold coins at the end of the rainbow. Because I would pester him to tell me all these stories of the golden days of working in movies at MGM, of all places. So that was The Wizard of Oz. It was The Wizard of Oz. I saw that and I said instantly, this is what I want to do. I want to get into storytelling and move people, with my stories. And as I said, my uncle was a special effects man that did that. So the whole, you know, the house falling on the witch and the tornado, you know, and the trees. Remember the apple trees that were throwing apples at Dorothy? And right. So he worked on that movie back in 1938, came out in 39. So I was always pestering him to tell me stories about Clark Gable and Carol Lombard and MGM and all that stuff. You know, it was fantastic. And here I am.
You can see my entire interview with John Crowley on the WBGO YouTube channel. The death of Hulk Hogan last week prompted our film critic, Harlan Jacobson, to remember that when he was 10, he saw a match at the Indianapolis State Fairgrounds between wrestling headliners Haystacks Calhoun and Dick the Bruiser. He picks up the story from there with a shout-out to offbeat wrestling movies you can catch up with this month.
Wrestling purists say Hulk Hogan, born Terry Jean Bollea and raised in Florida, was no pro. He was sloppy in his holds and moves, they said. This is like saying SpongeBob SquarePants, or Eric Cartman, the kid with the raging id on South Park, or even Beavis and Butthead, don't move fluidly the way Bambi, Dumbo, or Tramp do in Disney. You mean wrestlers aren't really fighting? Hogan parlayed his persona into a white working-class hero in Rocky III in 1982 as Thunderlips, who takes down Sylvester Stallone in a wrestler versus boxer match. He made a couple more forgettable films before starring in a sex tape with his buddy's wife, infelicitously publicized by Gawker, that resulted in his biggest payday, a $140 million judgment in an invasion of privacy lawsuit he won and settled for $31. Hogan blew past the art of wrestling into the then deeper recesses of white resentment and made wrestling a bigger business than when he entered it as an expendable 50 years ago, and died just shy of 72 last week, also in Florida, on the front page of the New York Times. Okay, below the fold. My brother in Chicago, my late brother, knew a jack of all trades named Angel, originally from Mexico, who on weekends would drive up to Minneapolis or down to Indianapolis to wrestle as a heel, a bad guy, who was fodder for someone whose career had gone better as a good guy and a crowd favorite. He suggested to Angel that he show up in pink tights and play it gay to give the crowd what it really feared. I don't know if Angel ever did that, but Gael Garcia Bernal played such a character, a nowhere runt wrestler out of El Paso, created by Saul Armendariz, who becomes an exotico by going pink and vaults to worldwide stardom on the Lucha Libre Mexican wrestling circuit in Cassandro, a 2023 movie by Roger Ross Williams, written by cinematographer David Teague. Here, his female trainer, Sabrina, played by Roberta Colindres, tells him where his destiny is.
You want to practice or are you just watching?
I've seen you fight at the Coliseum.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Lady Anarquia.
Sabrina.
Saul.
Hey.
Nice to meet you.
You fight there too?
No. Hmm. No, I've been doing some nights at the Taller Mecánico de Rai.
Oh, yeah. My students fight there sometimes. I don't think I've seen you. How long have you been doing lucha?
Since I was a kid. But I've been doing real fights since a couple of years ago. But I'm going to be fighting Gigantico de Tijuana next week. And I want to flip it. I want to turn it around. You know, quiero agarrar el culero. Quiero ponerlo ahí. Ponerle problemas.
You're hungry. You willing to work?
Yeah.
Come in here.
When Saul finally comes out as Cassandro, an exotico, he does it to be truthful to himself and to support his mother. The film is a body slam to all the backstage star melodramas that came before it. In Darren Aronofsky's 2008 The Wrestler, Mickey Rourke plays Randy the Ram Robinson, an aging wrestler who can't catch a break in enforced retirement and returns to the ring with a time bomb for a heart. Robert Siegel wrote The Wrestler as the nihilist's version of Rocky. Old guy meets a cute pole dancer, Marissa Tomei, outside the ring, and Rourke plays it like it's his own biopic.
Really good. You really brought it.
Thank you. Thank you.
You hang in there. You got a lot of ability.
Have you ever seen a one-trick pony and feel so happy and free?
I was wondering if I could get some more work.
All I got is weekends. Isn't that when you sit on other dudes' faces?
Have you ever seen a one-legged dog?
You have a beer with me? One beer.
If you've ever seen you have a daughter?
Oh, my daughter, she don't like me very much.
You should call her. Any you seen me?
What do you want from me?
I'm an old broken-down piece of meat, and I deserve to be all alone. I just don't want you to hate me.
Graham Robinson is what I like to think is true about Rourke. He doesn't know whether he will win or not, only that he's going to fly and die trying. I can't think of a better way to wrestle with the dog days of August than a double bill of Cassandro and Wrestler on Amazon Prime. And I'm Harlan Jacobson.
Thanks for listening to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. Join us next Saturday morning at 5:30 for another edition of the award-winning WBGO Journal. In the meantime, stay tuned to the world's greatest jazz and blues station, WBGO and WBGO.org.